wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today on the Old Mole, Movie Mole's Jan Hocken and Fran Michel revisit the 2010 documentary Marwan Call. If you ever saw the film, you are sure to remember it. Later, I'll tell you why we're revisiting this 8-year-old documentary. Following that, I'll be sharing an article entitled Climate Change is Increasing Regional Conflict and Creating Millions of Refugees Across the Globe by Steve Trent for the online news page Alternet. Closing our program today, Denise Morris previews a 2014 film called Pride that will be featured at an upcoming DSA event. The film is inspired by an extraordinary true story of cooperation between striking miners and gay and lesbian activists. Now, leading off today's program, Bill Resnick talks with Diane Feely in what I believe is the second part of a two-part interview. Diane Feely is coordinator of a national organization for women who has devoted her life to working in the labor movement and near all the social movements towards democratic socialist revolution. They discuss how to work with movements like Medicare for All, or Clean Renewable Energy, or Jobs for All at a Living Wage, or Housing for the Poor, all toward winning movement gains and also building knowledge of and commitments to radically democratic reconstruction. Bill?
Hi, Diane Feely. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Diane Feely worked a lot of jobs after college. She was a school teacher, a typesetter, spent at least 10 years on the assembly lines in Detroit, first with Ford and then with a spinoff of GM. It's called American Axle. In those years in Detroit and on the assembly line, she organized to build shop floor power, democratize the United Auto Workers. She was also active in Detroit and spent much of her life in Detroit, active through the years in many of the social movements, housing, redlining, minimum wage struggles, reproductive rights, civil rights, clean air and water, and of course challenging police violence, indeed the whole criminal justice system. And she remains now super active after retiring, mostly on Social Security, but some union pension and union medical care, very important. She also edits now and writes in the Journal Against the Current. So, Diane Feely, there's tremendous ferment, excitement, activism on the left. Ordinary folks are coming to realize that our current economic arrangements are devastating the environment and undermining working people at every level. And very remarkably, people are now intrigued by the idea of socialism and are souring on capitalism. It seems to me we can now put radical critique and radical program that another better, sustainable, and democratic world is necessary and possible, that we can put that on the agenda in politics at every level and also in daily life, at work, and in the home. You've been doing that for many years. So, Diane Feely, give us an example of how you've worked for these many years in labor struggles to build radical ideas and activate people.
Well, generally speaking, it happens around campaigns, and I would say the most important idea is solidarity, and that solidarity isn't just a slogan, a nice slogan, a moral issue, but it's actually a way of uniting us and protecting us. And in my plant, we had to vote on whether we were for two-tier wages or not. So we developed a campaign around that, and the leadership, almost complete leadership, said we had to support the idea of going to two-tier wages, that is, where we would make the top wage, but anyone coming in after us would make half of what we made and would have inferior benefits. But this would be done in order to keep the plant open. And otherwise, we would all be without a job. And we countered by developing a campaign against two-tier and saying that, in fact, the way unions survive is to protect the various generations of workers. And those who came before us fought not only for their wages and benefits, but fought for the conditions that we inherited. And we had to do the same to pass the torch. And that the idea of voting for a two-wage system would actually hurt us, in the sense of it would mean that we would be encouraged or intimidated into working harder, working more intensely, because we could get fired. And what would be the payoff? Well, two people could be hired for the price that we were earning. And people actually understood that and voted to oppose two-tier. Unfortunately, we weren't able to carry the campaign out to the other plants that were owned by the same corporation, so it was imposed upon us. But I think we can say, in general, workers now understand how two-tier just exacerbates inequality, and that more and more of us are working without any kind of job security. Even if we've got higher than average wage, usually there's very few benefits. So I think that idea has been tested over time, and that the idea of solidarity among generations and among different kinds of people, because obviously there are all these more vulnerable parts of the population need to be defended and can be best defended through the idea of solidarity. The other point is that it puts the burden of organizing on us, on the rank and file, rather than allowing the leadership to essentially mobilize when they wish to or sell us a bill of goods.
And people get activated then, right? They talk to their friends, and they begin in all of those discussions recognizing how power is wielded by the company and also by a lot of the people at the union who have been co-opted and earn really good salaries. Tell us about the activation of workers that come with that kind of campaign.
So we were unable to get the union to put out a button saying no two-tier. But I told my president, I want to get a button into the plant that people could wear. And she said to me, well, why don't you put out a leaflet and ask for contributions? And I did, and I was quite shocked that people were coming over and giving me a dollar bill, $5 bill. So we printed up 2,000 buttons and put out a little half sheet explaining the idea of why we were opposed to two-tier. And we actually had 50 people in the various plants that would get the button out and explain this. And one night I was sitting in the break room, and this guy I had never seen before, who came from another plant, is explaining why he was against two-tier using my arguments. And I felt like, wow, we have won. Everybody understands this. Well, there were a few people who didn't, but in general, the majority of people got it and were able to tell others about it. So that was a wonderful experience, as was later we had a strike. And one skilled trades guy said to me, you know, I never used to hang out with production people, but having gone through this strike, I'm united with them. Well, this is a white worker, skilled worker, who's saying this about an essentially black and female assembly line worker. So what he's saying is, again, about the need for solidarity.
You know, I know that in 2008, you folks organized a caravan to go to Washington. Why don't you talk about the caravan and the kind of consciousness that you were building about how, what in fact should happen to the all of those bankrupt auto plants?
Well, you know, here we work in an industry that I don't believe in. I don't believe we should be making cars and SUVs and trucks. So at the time of the crisis, we were able to not just talk within the plant, but have a much larger conversation about what could the auto industry contribute. And we talked about, it's an emergency right now in a double sense, not only a financial emergency, but a climate emergency. And just as during World Wars I and II, Detroit stopped making cars and started making war material, now, in this emergency, we could become the vanguard for what needs to be produced to stop and slow down the processes that are creating the CO2 and really become a model of what industry can do. And the other point that we make is that there's nothing magic about a 40-hour work week. In fact, many auto plants, including a Ford plant that I worked in, we worked far more than 40 hours a week. One plant, I worked 50 hours one week, 58 hours the next week. That was our usual pace. So people didn't have lives. We need lives and not just money to work. So I think these are important points to raise, and also to challenge one of the things that everyone says in our society, the economists, the media, even the leaders in the union, they're always talking about growth, how our society has to grow. You know, in Europe, they talk about degrowth because we can't keep growing every year, producing more CO2, using up more resources. We have to find a way of valuing other things, music, education, developing a social life. So these are the things that we try to raise instead of just talking about wages and benefits.
This is your Old Mill Variety Hour on KABU, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Diane Feely, a woman who did graduate college and went out in the work world and decided to become an organizer. She's done it in schools as a typesetter and especially as a member of the United Auto Workers working in the American Axle plant in Detroit, Michigan, and also active in all the social movements in Detroit and Michigan, including now, of course, the environmental movement. We've been talking about how one works in those movements to build popular consciousness of that other, better possible world. And we deserve it, and we can stand for it, and in solidarity we can collectively run it. Those are all some of the ideas that she was discussing. So how do you think that your caravan, for example, and other stuff that you've done, I know you visited plants in Mexico that, in fact, were worker-run, a tire plant, and you try and bring that message back and seed people's imagination that another better world is possible, that really we can work democratically together in solidarity instead of fighting one another around the world for the crumbs. To what extent do you think that those ideas have become parts of working class consciousness? Not that they don't also have ideas about how you have to defend yourself and work harder in order to stay afloat and get privileges for your kids. That's part of American life too. But I think they're beginning to realize that that other world is necessary and that it's possible.
Right. I mean, obviously, this is still very much of a minority point of view. I think there's two components. One is that most unions, and certainly my union, the UAW, sees things from the boss's point of view. That is, they believe that we have to negotiate with the company from the point of view of keeping them open and presumably producing the products that they're currently producing. That is, workers have no say in any aspect of production. And that position has been detrimental not only to the solidarity within the union as a way of keeping ourselves strong, but it's also led to tremendous corruption. So now the UAW leadership is facing charges, and actually some of them have been recently sentenced to prison. But the UAW was never like, say, the Hoffa Union. It was always sort of seen as a very clean union in which the top leaders didn't make that much more than the skilled tradesmen. So this is a big turnaround, and the reason is because of the cooperation between union and management that developed, especially around a team. We have to be a team, joint production, really essentially since the early 80s. The other idea that I wanted to raise, which is one that is becoming more popular, I wouldn't say necessarily it's at the rank and file level, but at least it's being talked about among activists, and that is the notion of just transition. That we are now in a situation where we cannot go on the way we are, and that the level of inequality and the level of climate change is so great that we have to change our ways of doing things. And in this just transition, we must take into account the workers who are working in the plants that have to be closed down or refitted, and the communities that surround them, which in some cases are the poorest communities and the ones that suffer from the most air pollution and toxic waste of all of us, and that these are the people that must come first in terms of understanding if we're going to make this transition, it must be done justly. That is, we must end the terrible inequality of our society.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Diane Feeley. We're talking about the changing consciousness of, particularly among the young, but everywhere, of the American working class and the movements that are developing. She's been working in all of them. Diane, it seems to me within the energy system, there's a consensus that we have to move towards renewable energy. The fossil fuel companies don't share that, but coal is both expensive and unhealthy, and the plants are closing, and new coal plants are not being even planned, although they do seem to think that you can do carbon capture, but basically that's all so expensive. But still, the investor-owned utilities, the corporate structure, they want to maintain their control of electricity, and they're trying to build their system. On the other side, though, there's like a state of California, which has gone the furthest. There's really the possibility of local distributed energy, that is, a lot of small installations and some larger ones producing electricity. And in fact, they'd be public agencies. Alameda County has now taken all of the customers of Pacific Gas and Electric, and that's its big investor-owned utility. It's like 500,000 customers, a big part of that company and its profits. And all of those people are now being served by East Bay Community Energy, it's called, that is now offering rates. Their rates are cheaper than what the PG&E is charging its other customers. It's more resilient, and it's building out local energy. And this would be democratically managed, provide local jobs, and also bring together many other movements in Alameda County, which is Oakland and Berkeley and Hayward, and some working class suburbs, some richer suburbs, and bring together all of the movements for public transit, for local food, for radically changing the way we live, for less working hours. They're bringing that all together into a movement that is, in fact, now inspiring people all over California. Almost every county now is moving towards, counties and cities are moving towards taking over their energy systems in one way or another. It seems to me that the energy system also offers this tremendous opportunity to talk about democratic organization and democratic running of the productive capacity of this country.
Yes, and I think one of the points that you make about municipalization is very important. And a lot of cities do own energy or water locally, and so that's a great beginning. Unfortunately, Detroit is really not in that situation. We have a big energy company that has about 10% at this point in renewables, and they're rolling out their plan and having a town hall meeting this Tuesday night in Detroit. And many activists are going to be going to that. What the energy company is saying is, we are committed to renewables, but at a very slow pace, because all of this has to be done on the consumer's dime. and we don't want to cause you very high rates. We don't want your rates to be going up. Well, we want to present a different perspective and use the meeting to try to educate folks about the fact that there's another way of doing this.
And it's a way of doing it that might save the planet. It's true, at their pace, because they have to recover all of their stranded costs. They can't have stranded costs. They can't have both a coal plant working or natural gas plants working at, and also then move towards renewables, you would have a huge excess of electricity then. So they want to pay off their assets, that is, amortize them, get all the profits possible out of them, and then move towards renewable energy. Well, of course, the planet is warming and warming and warming, and California is burning. That's not a feasible program, and it's not a feasible program to make the people pay. It really has to be the investment houses who have funded all of this stuff, and in fact, the rich. We have to mobilize as if in World War II, and some of those rich people are going to have to sacrifice.
Climate change is a big problem, not only because of the amount of CO2 that we're putting in the air, but the pace has accelerated. And what we have to do is really move into reverse, and to reverse very quickly, because essentially the IPCC report indicates that we've got 12 years to basically cut CO2 in half. So it's we've got this dozen years, and we've got to use it well.
Yes, I think that we're near a point where people are going to begin rising up around that program. I hope so. I hope in our lifetime. Diane Feeley, thanks a lot. Keep up the good work. I know that's, I don't have to urge you to it. You've had a lifetime of it. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Right.
This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Omo Variety Hour. Of course, was John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band. Now Movie Mole's Jan Hawken and Fran Michelle are here to discuss the 2010 documentary Marwin Call. It's about a man who, after a vicious attack which left him brain damaged, created a 1-6 scale model of a World War II era town in his backyard as a form of therapy. A narrative version of this story is soon to be released called Welcome to Marwin, starring Steve Carell.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Jan Hawken to discuss Marwin Call, a documentary directed by Jeff Malmberg about the life and art of Mark Hogenkamp, who has created a 1-6 scale World War II era fictional Belgian town called Marwin Call, populated with Barbie dolls and action figures based on Hogenkamp and his friends, family, and acquaintances. Hogenkamp began the project as a form of therapy after being beaten into a coma by five men 10 years ago outside a bar in his small hometown of Kingston, New York. When a local photographer sees the photos Hogenkamp takes of scenes from the ongoing story of Marwin Call, Hogenkamp's work is reproduced in an art magazine and he's given a gallery show in New York. One of the things that the filmmaker acknowledged is that when he first heard about Hogenkamp's work and saw his work, he thought the idea of a grown man playing with dolls is a little bit creepy.
Well, I think we're able to enter into his world and the elaborate scenes he creates through kind of action figure GI dolls, boy dolls and girl dolls, Barbie dolls, because we understand right at the beginning that he suffered a terrible trauma, and on one level it's kind of a straightforward exploration of how a person who suffers trauma attempts to gain control over their world by manipulating and orchestrating the actions and the stories of people in this world who don't speak back or respond with their own agency like the people he encounters in daily life. He carries his world into a place where he can control every movement and all the storylines.
Yeah, and so when he has his alter ego in Marwin Call beaten up by Nazis, because, you know, the Nazis are always the bad guys, the SS comes to town and tortures Captain Hogenkamp. But he's rescued by the women of the town of Marwinkall, who burst in with their guns blazing and kill all the Nazis and save Captain Hogenkamp. So he can sort of reenact the trauma in ways that are safe and to give it a different outcome. Poor Captain Hogenkamp doesn't have to spend 9 days in a coma and another 40 in the hospital and relearn how to speak and relearn how to walk the way that his creator has to. Instead, he suffers, but he's rescued.
Unlike Vietnam vets or other wars that were part of this man's likely history and historical memory, this was a war with, as you said, very straight, clear lines and victorious soldiers and also women. Who the contemporary motifs of this world he creates involve Barbie dolls, who are very much girl dolls, but they're dolls out in the world of men. But he really creates a kind of dominatrix characters out of these girls and out of the Barbie dolls. And that was very interesting. I think part of what might have been unsettling to many people was the tremendous interest he has in girl dolls, Barbie dolls, and all of their accessories, the kind of attending to their hair and the details of their clothes and all of that, which generally is coded as gay, to be that interested in the world of girls and female culture.
Yeah, I mean, he really is obsessively careful and detailed and meticulous in constructing these characters and the props that all work, and the gun has a little clip that comes out. I mean, he knows better, but he feels that they're real people. So when he walks through town, he drags the Jeep with the soldiers in it, partly to wear down the wheels so that they get a more realistic, worn-out look instead of having that seam from where they were made in the factory, but also because he feels that having the well-armed troops with him protects him. And so he feels safe. And then when he goes to bed at night, he has three of the girl dolls get tucked in a little doll bed next to him. And, you know, he wishes them good night. And there's one point in the film where he's redressing one of the dolls and her head pops off and he says, sorry. He apologizes to them. I mean, so they're clearly, you know, there's a really strong investment emotionally in these figures, which is a little bit, you know, is a little bit childlike. And I mean, sort of fits with the idea that he's been traumatized and he has to relearn everything. And so he's sort of going back to this stage of play, of being able, the way that children can, to invest dolls with their own life and story and creativity. But, you know, if for an adult to be doing that might be kind of creepy, but there is something kind of childlike about the way he engages in it.
And the documentary kind of keeps him, on the one hand, in a childlike position. And so when he becomes very obsessed with one of the women in his world, who becomes a central figure and love interest in his imaginary world, this would be quite disturbing to have someone obsessed with you in such a way. But I think the fact that he's been traumatized, and in a way the film keeps him in a kind of childlike stance, and we might wonder if that costs something to keep him so much as this asexual person, that his sexuality remained very innocent and his obsessions remained innocent. But on the other hand, it was a kind of antidote to the way in which people who are marginalized through mental illness or other victims of trauma become kind of cast in a very maniacal way. I mean, this man was very creative, and there was a respectful tone throughout. He was the narrator of his own story. He struggled with things. He was quite thoughtful and reflective in many places.
And I think some of that is indicated by the fact that the way that Malmberg, the director of the film, shoots the figures from Marwinkall, I mean, the very first images we see are the same kinds of shots that Hogenkamp does. That is, he gets down in among the characters and figures so that they're up there on the big screen looking life-size rather than Barbie doll-size. So there's a kind of intimacy and entering into it visually that I think signals the kind of respect that the filmmaker invites us to have for this really impressive work of imagination.
Yeah, he has this craft as an artist that is quite complex, that requires a kind of close look to appreciate the complexity of what he does. And in a way, it opens up the question of the complexity of the world of children as well through their play. And I looked at Barbie dolls in a new way after watching this, because on one level, the Barbie doll culture is not just about anorexic figures. It's about girls or female figures as the bearers of commodity fetishism. It's about shopping and accessories and endless little purchases to equip properly your Barbie doll. And he takes that in a different direction in creating his world in response to his trauma.
Yeah, I think you underestimate the creativity of little girls playing with Barbies, Jan, when you say that, because I think that, I mean, on the one hand, clearly Barbie is a commodity and a hugely profitable one and designed to encourage girls to get her house, get her accessories, et cetera, et cetera.
Even but her I little briefcase.
I think that the way that children play with these toys is not necessarily simply in line with the commodity culture that they are being on another level also inaugurated or invited into or trained in. And I think we could sort of see that in some ways in that move beyond that sort of commodity relation to these things. If we think about or the few clues we have in the film about how he manages to finance this art project, because we're told at the beginning that he starts doing this because he no longer had coverage for therapy. And so his physical therapy and his psychological therapy ended in terms of any kind of professional help that he was going to get from medical professionals. And so it's his own project to heal himself that starts this. So he, you know, in working with the little tiny props and dressing the dolls, he's working on manual dexterity and hand-eye coordination and things that were really, because his hand shakes. He was a talented artist. We see some of his sketches from before the beating, but he can't draw anymore because his hands shake so much, and so he's trying to retrain himself physically, but also clearly playing out on a psychological level some of these things. But then you start to wonder, well, if he couldn't afford therapy, how come he could afford all these dolls? Because they're not cheap either. But there's a brief scene where we meet some folks in town who run the hobby shop, and they know Mark, and they want to help him out, and they know he's having a hard time, and so they kind of pass things his way. And so you get the sense that these dolls and these props are not actually, you know, they're circulating through this network of sympathy and community rather than simply through the cash nexus. He's not just going out and buying all this stuff, but some of it's being given to him and some of it he's making himself out of old scraps of things. So, I mean, it's really a sort of step outside of the purely commoditized relation to dolls and miniatures and those sorts of things.
This is Fran Michel and Jan Hocken today talking about the documentary Marwin Call. This also, I think, suggests that therapy for him is not just about creating an isolated world of his own making where he orchestrates people in a way he can't engage in reality. We also see him using these figures as representations of people he cares about in his world, kind of looking for the actual, kind of, we might say, the good objects, the nurturers or the sustaining people in his world. And he moves back and forth between the world he's created through this play and interactions with real people, which I think does characterize a lot of people who have been psychologically traumatized, that there is a way in which moving in and out of the everyday world is a real critical process. And it's not just about being in reality as we know it or outside of it.
Yeah, and I mean, we sort of can get a sense of the extent to which his relation with the filmmaker develops, because by the end of the film, we learn that there's a Jeff doll who's a filmmaker in the little world of Marwin Call, right? So that this character has become integrated into that world. But it's clear also that Hogenkamp wants to share it. I mean, the photographer who first meets him while he's dragging his little Jeep down the street and is sort of puzzled by this and stops to talk to him finds out about the whole story when Mark gives him a big fat envelope full of photographs with the captions on the back explaining the story. So he really wants to share this. He wants to be open about the world that he's created. He wants other people to see it and appreciate it. And so he is in a kind of constant process of moving back and forth and negotiating that line and that relation.
Another, I think, impressive theme in the documentary was the way in which the filmmaker and the subject negotiated the various aspects of his entry into the public stage. You really see him going through this process of putting his work out there, whether he wanted to or not, and often that's done behind the scenes. But I think that we were drawn into understanding his ambivalence as well about being exploited in ways he didn't anticipate, and engagement in the broader society in ways that he didn't understand where that would take him.
But I think it's safe to say that we both would recommend Marwin Call as a story that explores imagination and identity and gender and trauma and
memory and outsider art.
For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel and Jan Hawken discussing the documentary Marwin Call.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The documentary Marwin Call is available at the Multnomah Library. The narrative film Welcome to Marwin, based on the documentary and starring Steve Carell, will open, I believe, around Christmas. We constantly hear in the climate change debates that if all the nations of the world, particularly the industrialized world, begin immediately to work in concert, the most dire and cataclysmic effects of climate change can still be avoided. But even if this were true, and we've been hearing this refrain for decades, and we somehow managed to pull back from the brink of total devastation, some adverse climate change effects are already beyond remedy. Drought, torrential rains, floods, violent storms, rising oceans, heat waves, and other climatic disruptions are already locked and loaded. In such a scenario, huge climate-driven migrations of peoples are sure to arise as areas of the planet become unfit for human habitation. What are the chances that such a massive movement of peoples can be managed peacefully? Today, I am sharing an article entitled Climate Change is Increasing Regional Conflict and Creating Millions of Refugees Across the Globe by Steve Trent for the online news page Alternet. From the imagery of climate change, Trent begins, you could be mistaken for thinking it is all about polar bears. Actually, climate change is all about all life on our planet, and a threat to humanity is great or greater than geopolitical conflict or terrorism. Rising temperatures and changing rainfall patterns will intensify competition for resources, food, and water. Rising sea levels and extreme weather events will displace even greater numbers of people. The Environmental Justice Foundation's last report, Beyond Borders, outlines the link between a changing climate, migration, and conflict, and how climate change can be seen as a threat multiplier. Displacement as a consequence of climate change is not something happening only far away or in a distant future. In February, former U.S. National Security Advisor Richard Clark said that climate change is the greatest single risk to California and to the entire United States, a warning that was followed by Hurricanes Harvey and Irma, which hit the U.S. and a number of Caribbean islands with devastating impacts, causing flooding, destruction, and forcing people to leave their homes. At the same time in the U.S., dry conditions and extreme heat have led to a proliferating number of intense wildfires, causing massive damage to infrastructure, land, and loss of human life. These events are all increasing in frequency and are magnified as a result of climate change, and they give us a glimpse into a future we all face. The strength and frequency of hurricanes and storms, drought and wildfires will increase dramatically. Since 2008, weather-related hazards, which are magnifying and multiplying as a result of climate change, displace more than 59,600 people every day, or 41 people every minute. Millions more were forced to leave their homes due to prolonged droughts and their devastating impacts. In Bangladesh, 1 meter of sea level rise would equate to a loss of 17% to 20% of territory. The government estimates that would create around 25 million climate refugees, while other experts suggest near 35 million. Bangladesh does not have the capacity to absorb such mass displacement. Most poorer countries do not. So refugees will be forced into neighboring countries. And as the basic necessities of life become precious commodities, the risk of conflict will surge. Well, senior military figures in Bangladesh have pointed urgently to these threats, making clear that peace is at risk not just in their country, but across South Asia and the rest of the world. Senior military figures from Britain to the United States have raised a similar alarm, identifying climate change and the accompanying threats to our national and global security as a cause for urgent action. They are warning world leaders of the need to cut our addiction to carbon today. Mass displacement caused by climate change can also ignite or exacerbate conflict. While no serious observer would claim that climate change caused the conflict in Syria, it is clear that it magnified and multiplied many of the stresses that led into the explosion of violence. Not least important was that over 1 million people were on the move from drought-stricken regions before a single gunshot was fired. The prolonged drought in Syria, coupled with devastating climate events, wildfires, droughts and storms in major grain-producing areas that reduced the 2010-11 harvest and doubled the global price of wheat in 6 months, left people hungry, poor, and on the move. Al-Assad's failure to respond to the needs of Syria's desperate people was one spark to the outbreak of the bloody conflict. Climate change is increasingly viewed as a threat multiplier, driving the likelihood of violent conflict arising from pre-existing and complex interactions between political, economic, religious, ethnic, or other cultural forces. The challenge facing us is complex. In a rapidly changing world, climate change and its potential to trigger both mass migration and violent conflict need to be considered as urgent priorities for policymakers and business leaders. And we must consider that those who are least to blame for climate change are those who are all too often affected first and worst. The world's least developed countries produce only a fraction of global greenhouse gas emissions and have had far fewer of the benefits reaped by the developed world from their carbon-based economies. Yet they are the most vulnerable and the least able to respond effectively to the impacts of climate change. We need a development of a new legally binding agreement to protect climate refugees. This instrument will give definition and status to climate refugees, to define rights and obligations, and to coordinate and combine our actions so that they are effective. We cannot hope to deal with the wave of suffering and the disruption as single nations. It will not work. We are all better served, better prepared, and better protected if we act together. For climate refugees, tomorrow will be too late. That was an article entitled Climate Change is Increasing Regional Conflict and Creating Millions of Refugees Across the Globe by Steve Trent for the online news page Aldernet. Steve Trent is the co-founder and executive director of the Environmental Justice Foundation.
Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears while we all some sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Our hard times come again no more. Is the song the sigh of the weary? Hard times come again no more.
That was, of course, Bob Dylan singing the 1854 Stephen Foster song, Hard Times. Wrapping up our program today, Denise Morris gives us a preview of a 2014 film called Pride that will be featured at an upcoming DSA event. It's the summer of 1984. Margaret Thatcher is in power and the National Union of Mine Workers is on strike, prompting a London-based group of gay and lesbian activists to raise money to support the strikers' families. Initially rebuffed by the union, the group identifies a tiny mining village in Wales and sets off to make their donation in person. As the strike drags on, the two groups discover that standing together makes for the strongest union of all.
In 2014, 30 years after the historic UK National Union of Mine Workers strike from 1984 to 1985, two films were released. Still the Enemy Within is a documentary directed by Owen Gower and narrated by surviving mine workers who participated in the strike. The mine workers were called the enemy within by Margaret Thatcher and a conservative government, quote, intent on free market reform of the nationalized industries, which included plans for the closure of most of Britain's remaining coal pits. The public perception of militancy on the part of the National Union of Mine Workers still persists more than 30 years later. In a 2014 article by Georgia Rose for Vice magazine, director Owen Gower was asked to talk about the film's title, Still the Enemy Within. Quote, Margaret Thatcher herself called the miners the enemy within, and 30 years later they still have that label. The argument that they are not crazy militants waging war on the government has still not been won. It's still a dominant narrative of the strike. The other side of it is that they are still proud to wear that label, and they still believe in fighting for a better world today. It's about saying that the miners' strike is not just a piece of history, it's still ongoing. Regarding the struggles of the 1980s and their echo in the current political situation today, Gower comments, quote, Thatcher's project was to roll back everything that came out of the 1945 consensus, public services, nationalized industries, and so on. The miners knew that if they lost, it would be more than their communities that would be destroyed. There would be a weakening of unions as well as privatizations across the board. And that is what we're seeing today. Wages and pensions are being cut, and the gap between the rich and poor is deepening. The film Pride is the narrative counterpart to Still the Enemy Within. Directed by Matthew Warchus from a screenplay by Stephen Beresford, Pride is inspired by the true story of a London-based group of gay and lesbian activists and their efforts to raise money to support striking mine worker families. The film has been well received and won several high-profile awards, and thanks to the organizing efforts of our friends in the Portland chapter of Democratic Socialists of America, Pride will be shown on November 20th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Tickets will be by donation on a sliding scale of $5 to $10, but no one will be turned away. More information on that later. Described as feel-good, uplifting, and a comedy whose, quote, laughs are as fierce as its politics, Pride indeed is the film that deserves to be seen, and this opportunity to see it on the big screen with an audience dedicated to social justice will be a good time. The music is good, the early 80s fashion is real good, and the struggle is epic. Pride picks up in the summer of 1984 with Margaret Thatcher in power and the National Union of Mine Workers on strike. Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners is born on the day of the 1984 Gay Pride March in London, as a group of activists decide to raise money to support the families of striking miners. Not all gay liberation activists are on board, unable to envision the value in supporting people who don't support them. But emerging leader Mark Ashton understands the power of solidarity in the face of a common enemy. As he passes collection buckets to somewhat indifferent marchers, Mark explains, quote, I want everyone to take a bucket and start rattling. This is for the miners. It's a show of solidarity. Who hates the miners? Thatcher. Who else? The police, the public, and the tabloid press. Sound familiar? The task of finding mining towns to support was difficult as the union feared association with deviants. At last, LGSM identifies a mining village in Deepest Wells and set off in a minibus to make their donation in person. Solidarity is at the core of this film, rightly so, as not all mine workers went out on strike, and the strike was deemed illegal because a national vote was not conducted. Divide and conquer was in full force, and the police were deployed to intimidate mine workers and their families, resulting in violence and mass arrests. These the same police who harassed and brutalized queers in London. Margaret Thatcher claimed, quote, There is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families. In response, director Matthew Warchus counters, quote, Pride's main characters fervently believe in the opposite, in the power of unity. Mark Ashton, a real-life activist who also worked with the Communist Party of Great Britain, understood the greater good in unity, and in the film is portrayed as unapologetic for his gayness and dedicated to solidarity. Quote, One community should give solidarity to another. It is really illogical to say, I'm gay, and I'm into defending the gay community, but I don't care about anything else. again from director Matthew Wirtjes, quote, "Both groups in the film, LGSM and the Welsh Miners, are certainly politically minded, but it's their humanity that's so compelling. Pride engages the audience not in party politics or preachy agendas, but in much bigger concepts of generosity and compassion. The film humorously depicts the developing relationship between apparent opposites who somehow overcome the obstacles between them. In a way, it's a classic romantic comedy, but the relationship isn't between individuals, but between two groups or communities, and they are driven not by romantic love, but by compassion. I think it reminds us of the idea of society, that there is, of course, such a thing after all." Pride, released in 2014, 30 years after the devastating defeat of mine workers to Thatcher's United Kingdom, reminds us that victories do emerge from defeats. The Pride story is told with humor, compassion, and insight, and you can see it on the big screen at the Clinton Street Theater, November 20th, 7 p.m. For tickets, go to portlanddsa.org calendar, where you can purchase advance tickets, $5 to $10 suggested donation. No one will be turned away, and all proceeds go to pay for the event. I'll end with a tiny note on music. In response to a damaging tabloid article accusing mine workers of collaborating with perverts, the LGSM organized the fundraiser Pits and Perverts, featuring synth-pop band Bronski Beat. The event was a huge success. Not a surprise that the Red Wedge Collective of musicians formed in the UK in 1985, attempting to engage young people with politics in general, and the politics of the Labour Party in particular, in the hope of ousting the Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher. The Iron Lady would remain in office through 1990. The anti-establishment, anti-authoritarian music of the late 70s and early 80s will always live large in my heart. So for Veterans Day, I think Bronski Beat, No More War, is a nice way to end. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, today talking about the film Pride, showing at the Clinton Street Theater, November 20th.
No more war, please. No more destruction.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles to chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. You'll also see on that page that you can subscribe to our podcast, and there are links to download the relevant app. You might have to type the show name into the app search bar to find us. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions or commentary, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at our email address, oldmolevarietyhour, all one word, at gmail.com.